Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
The way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd. That is Frank Sinatra, of course, singing They Can't Take That Away From Me. We start with that song today first because it's a classic by George and Ira Gershwin, and they wrote it for the Fred Astaire film Shall We Dance, released in 1937. It represents pretty much everything we mean when we say a standard or a great American song. It has a kind of sophisticated artistry that sounds utterly casual. This version's also noteworthy because it was recorded by Sinatra for his 1954 album, Songs for Young Lovers. That was Sinatra's first album in his tremendous collaboration with conductor-arranger Nelson Riddle. It was pretty much the start of the singer's musical comeback. All of that and the sentiment expressed in the song, a kind of loving defiance or resilience, play central roles in Ben Yagoda's music history, the B-side, The Death of Tin Pan Alley and the Rebirth of the Great American Song, which is out in paperback tomorrow. Ben Yagoda is a cultural journalist and historian, a professor of journalism at the University of Delaware. He's written a number of books, including a biography of Will Rogers and a history of memoirs. Ben, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here.
If you wish to join our conversation, you can call 800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Ben, your book, The B-Side, starts with the decline of the classic American songs in the late 40s, early 50s, but then it flashes back to Tin Pan Alley. And that was the name for the sheet music industry that came to be headquartered in the Brill Building in Manhattan. And this was in the early years of the 20th century, and that was the launching pad for this remarkable explosion of talent. Irving Berlin, Jerome Kern, Cole Porter, these were the artists who invented what we call today the classic American song. So I want to start with a big, dumb, loaded question. What is a standard? What makes an American song a classic and not just a tune with a great hook or just a popular song from a particular historical era?
Well, I don't think I can give you a great answer. It's a very good question. Maybe because it's such a good question, there's no definitive answer. But let me take a couple of stabs at it. Number one is whether the song has lasted. So if we can hear a Frank Sinatra singing a Riddle arrangement of They Can't Take That Away From Me in 2015, which is 78 years, if my math is correct, after its appearance in that film, well, then, you know, it's a standard. Now, that's sort of a negative rather than a positive argument. That is, the song hasn't fallen away. I asked that question to a great jazz pianist named Bill Charlap, who just came out, actually, with a collaboration with Tony Bennett on Jerome Kern's songs. The great Tony Bennett, still going strong at age 90. And Bill Charlap had grown up in this milieu. His father was a songwriter, Moose Charlap, a composer of the musical Peter Pan and other songs, and hung around with all the great composers of the day. And one of them, Julie Stein, one of the last people in this tradition. Bill Charlap asked Julie Stein what made a standard. And Stein gave a very simple answer that's kind of deep despite its simplicity. He said, it had to be melodically simple and harmonically attractive. And to me, that says a lot, that a melody can't be too complicated. It can't go all over the place. It can't be too simple, on the other hand. And the harmonics can't be simple. It has to be attractive. It has to be something you could sink your teeth into that great singers, that great jazz musicians can make new things out of. And I guess the one thing that Stein didn't say, being a composer, is the lyrics have to be great as well. And the one you played, They Can't Take That Away From Me, has one of the great lyrics of all time by Ira Gershwin. The way it moves from the simple quotidian examples, the way you hold your knife, to the killer sacco, the way you changed my life. Mm. I mean, it doesn't get any better than that.
Ted Gioia, the music historian, the author of the Jazz Canon, who lives in the Dallas area, he defined a standard in a way that's kind of similar to what you were saying, that it lasted. He defines a standard as a song that a musician picks up and interprets, and other musicians then agree. They find things in it worth interpreting and reinterpreting. So it becomes this kind of conversation back and forth down the years. And it's only then that it becomes a standard. In other words, a standard doesn't necessarily have some intrinsic quality built into it. Like many standards have kind of silly lyrics, for instance. But becoming a standard is something that happens to a song over time.
I think that's absolutely right. You can't write a standard and come out of your typewriter or your computer and say, hey, it's a standard. It has to stand the test of time. And, you know, I think jazz is such a key part of it, that these composers coming out in the 20s that really established this tradition, Gershwin, Berlin, Kern, later Arlen, Cole Porter, Richard Rodgers, really understood jazz. Jazz was coming into its own at the same time, the new kind of harmonies, much more complicated, sophisticated, and subtle than the earlier Tin Pan Alley tunes like, you know, Let Me Call You Sweetheart and Sidewalks of New York and things like that. And then by the same token, as Ted Gioia points out, the song is written, and then these musicians and singers begin to interpret it. And yeah, in fact, you're right about the lyrics. Some of them are very simplistic, like there will never be another you, although, you know, it has a certain profundity to it. To me, the music is the main thing, but the lyrics can add quite a lot.
There certainly were popular songs before Tin Pan Alley, as you mentioned, folk songs, arias from operas. So why Tin Pan Alley? Why did this place, this period, this industry become such a generative force?
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned the Brill Building, which is an office building on Broadway in the 40s, still exists in New York. And Tin Pan Alley actually started before the Brill Building became an important place. Around the turn of the 20th century, the sheet music industry, which was the music industry at that time, was located on West 26th Street between 5th and 6th Avenue. And all the publishers were there. And in the summertime, the song pluggers would be trying out their songs, auditioning, with the windows thrown open, and it sounded like tin pans clanging together, hence the name Tin Pan Alley. And that stage of the business, as it was starting out and really beginning to mature, came about, I would say, as the growth of a kind of urban middle class in the country. Sheet music being the most important thing, that was the way songs were disseminated. It was before radio, before recordings, and most middle-class families had a piano and at least one people who could play the piano, and that was how the songs were sold, and that was how money was made, through the sale of sheet music. And that fact had something to do with the nature of these songs, the sort of pre-1920 songs. They were simpler than the later jazz standards, and they also often went on and on and on and on, chorus after chorus after chorus, because the family, you know, it was great. They could sit around and just sing to their heart's content. Later on, when recordings came into play in the 20s and the length of the song had to be limited to less than 4 minutes, that actually had good effects on helping out with the sophistication of the songs when and professional musicians played them instead of just, you know, mother or sister in the drawing room. That was one of the things that led to the increasing complexity and subtlety of these songs.
It also is a factor that Tin Pan Alley is a very American kind of invention. It's partly because it is in New York, isn't it?
Oh, totally New York. And for years and years and years, that was where songs got made and recorded and sold. The immigrant population at the turn of the century, I mean, it's a pretty obvious fact that a strong majority of the best songwriters and of songwriters in general were Jewish. And people have been debating back and forth exactly why that is. It's another question that I can't give you a definite answer to, but it definitely was the case. And people like Gershwin and Harold Arlen in particular, took some of the minor key melodies of the synagogue into their music. In fact, one of the most prominent songwriter who was not Jewish was Cole Porter. Mm-hmm. He always said the secret to his success was writing in the Jewish manner. A lot of his minor key melodies, like Got You Under My Skin and Love for Sale and Begin the Beginning and so forth. Yeah.
In reading about Tin Pan Alley, I'm occasionally reminded of Neil Gabler's terrific history, An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. And it's about how a certain group of people, often Jewish immigrants, connect with a new technology and art form. And to that, they bring their business skills in management and distribution. And that's pretty much the story of American popular culture. If you add in a large African-American influence in there through jazz or blues or whatever, that's kind of, I mean, that's films, that's music, that's television, that's kind of American culture.
I think that you make a good point, and especially in the early days of Tin Pan Alley, when these publishers were establishing themselves at the turn of the century or soon afterwards, the big publishers were all basically Jewish merchants who had sold dry goods or Max Dreyfus had gone around the country selling notions and took these business skills, as you mentioned, and salesmanship. And in some cases, great taste. Max Dreyfus was just a wonderful supporter of the art of the song to this. And yeah, the parallels with the movie tycoons and moguls are definitely there.
It is, you cite Max Dreyfus's musical taste, but it's also explains the common touch that many of them were not that well-versed, that the song had to appeal to someone with not the most tutored ear.
Right. And, you know, songs had to go through a gauntlet of, I mentioned the song pluggers who would, if a publisher took on a song by a Gershwin, then it would be given to the plugger who would try to sell it to bandleaders and singers and later record companies. And so there was a test at every stage of the way. Abstruse, quote-unquote, artistic songs wouldn't cut it. And then once they were out, it was the marketplace. If a song in once recordings had started, if it sold, that was pretty apparent if you just picked up Billboard and read it every week. So, yeah, they had to go through a crucible, all these songs, to become successful. And, you know, if it was a Broadway show, it had to be worked on again and again through the director and the previews. Hollywood had to go through the studio staff. And so, yeah, this wasn't coming just out of the people's fingers into the piano and became a song right then and there. It was a long process.
So the artists were pretty much for hire. They were freelancers. And although they might have like an office in the sense of a piano in a little cubicle, they were just churning out product. And everything else was done above them, above their pay grade.
Right. And of course, there was a pecking order. I mean, at the top was an Irving Berlin or a Gershwin who became, you know, entities. And and also, more generally, at the top of the pecking order were the composers who wrote for Broadway. Rodgers and Hart, later Rodgers and Hammerstein. Below them were those like Harry Warren who are on staff in Hollywood. Then there was the mass of kind of one-off writers hoping for a hit.
We'll be coming back to our discussion of the history of the Great American Songbook and what happened to it in a moment. Please stay with us. And you can join this conversation at 800-933-5372. I'm talking to Ben Yagoda, the author of The B-Side.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test-prep.
Good morning, honey. You old Good morning, heartache. Thought we said goodbye last night. I turned and tossed until it seemed you had gone. But here you are with the dawn.
That, of course, is the great Billie Holiday singing Good Morning Heartache. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd on Think. And we're talking with Ben Yagoda, the author of a popular music history called The B-Side. And what's interesting about the creation of Good Morning Heartache is that it was co-written by Irene Higginbotham, one of the very few female songwriters from the Great American Songbook period, and remarkably, also one of the very few African-American women who was a member of ASCAP, and that's the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. Now, Tin Pan Alley was incredibly creative. It transformed the Broadway musical and the Hollywood soundtrack. It helped make jazz part of our repertoire. But its sound didn't represent America. And that country club exclusionary quality was maintained well into the 40s by ASCAP. Ben, could you talk a little bit about what that meant and what that exclusionary status led to?
Excuse me, absolutely. ASCAP, that country club analogy is not a bad one. ASCAP, American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, started in 1914, basically because nightclub performers, singers, and bands were playing songs without compensating the publishers and the writers of the songs. And those people didn't think it was fair. They formed an organization to get revenue from them, and they won in the courts. Shortly after that, radio came along, and radio became the main source of ASCAP income. Radio networks had to pay a flat fee each year to ASCAP, who would distribute it, that fee among its members. The problem was, or one of the problems was, as you said, it was tough to get into ASCAP. You had to have, it was sort of a catch-22. You had to have a song published to get into ASCAP, but you couldn't have a song published if you weren't in ASCAP. And people like W.C. Handy and African Americans and country people like country and Western writers and performers like Gene Autry just could not get in. It was pretty much a New York and Hollywood closed club. And that came back to bite ASCAP in its foot or other parts of the anatomy some years later. They were in a monopoly, so each year through the 20s and 30s, they would ask the radio networks for more and more money, knowing they had their networks cross a barrel, until finally in 1941, the network said, no, we're not going to play anymore. We are not going to use your music. And for a year, it was called the ASCAP Ban. They played classical pieces, Stephen Foster pieces in the public domain, and they started to sign up some of these writers who had not been able to make it into ASCAP to a new licensing organization called Broadcast Music Incorporated, BMI. And of course, the ASCAP ban only lasted a year. ASCAP came back to the airwaves, but BMI was still there. BMI is still here. And all of a sudden, this other kind of music, so-called hillbilly music, rhythm and blues, country music, started to be heard on the airwaves. And, that was one of the things that led to the big change later on.
Now, the heart of your book is how that comes apart, how ASCAP's control the popular appeal of jazz and these kinds of well-crafted songs, and ultimately even the Broadway musical. And it's often been seen as a kind of generational, even almost Oedipal war, that the baby boomers and the teenagers go big for rock and roll and reject their parents' fuddy-duddy music. But you argue in The B-Side that the Great American Song was already disappearing by the time Elvis and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis hit the airwaves. Why? What replaced it?
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, Elvis came upon the scene in 1955, 56, along with Rock Around the Clock and other figures that you mentioned. But already in 1947, 1948, people were bemoaning the lack of good songs. And the change really started after World War II. A lot of things were going on. And you mentioned jazz. That was big. The big bands, the swing bands, were the main disseminator of these great songs. From the mid-30s through the mid-40s. After the war, most of them summarily broke up and disbanded. It became too expensive. The tastes among the public had changed. Young people who went out to Jitterbug before the war were coming back from the war, the men were, and they frankly seemed to want simpler things, not as complex or challenging things. So, you know, the song well before rock and roll that's usually hauled out by me and others as this kind of symbol for the decline in popular songs was "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?" The biggest hit of 1953, and you know, a pleasant ditty. I play it when I give talks, and people smile and sing along. And, you know, and in a way, it was a return back to those songs of the 1900s and teens that you could sing along to, that was simple, that wasn't too challenging. So tastes were really changing. And then economic things changed as well. Roughly a third of the great standards came out of Broadway, a third came out of Hollywood, and a third out of Tin Pan Alley. After the war, for mostly economic but also other reasons, Hollywood stopped making musicals for the most part. They did versions of Broadway musicals, and they did shows like The Bandwagon that used old songs and Singin' in the Rain, but very few new original musicals compared to the dozens and dozens and dozens that were made in the 30s and 40s. So that was another thing that was happening at the time. And the generation gap, the phrase hadn't been invented yet, really was a thing that was going on as well. You mentioned the baby boomers, and absolutely, you know, before the war, there was much more of a unity in American culture. But in music, after the war, even the formats changed, that the young people had the 45 singles and the grown-ups the 33 and a third LPs.
And there's one figure in your book who kind of rides this wave, who helps cause this change. Now, these are generational and cultural and industrial changes going on, but he also has a profound influence, and that's Mitch Miller. And I was wondering if you could explain why and how he became such a figure.
Sure. You know, to some people, Mitch Miller is known as the bearded man doing the sing-alongs, and his albums and TV shows Sing Along with Mitch. Some people, the name will mean nothing at all. Not many people are aware of the fact that from roughly 1950 to 1960, he was the head of popular recording at Columbia Records, the biggest record company in the country and the most powerful person, single person in the pop music business. Very successful, a lot of number one hits. But the thing that was often said about Miller was that he really didn't like popular music. He viewed it, you know, to use the term you used before, as a commodity. He was into making hit records. He was very good at it. A lot of production values, overdubbing, sound effects.
And a lot of gimmicks, like dog barking.
Yeah, Mama Will Bark, Frank Sinatra, I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus, A Pigeon Armenian, Come On to My House with Rosemary Clooney. anything to make a hit, and he was very good, but he really didn't, I feel, have an appreciation for great popular songs or for jazz. Mitch Miller came out of classical music. He was a oboe prodigy and a great oboist before he went into the record business. And, you know, I think it is true that to him, classical music was the real great music. Everything else was just a product.
I'm old enough to remember visiting friends' homes and seeing Sing Along with Mitch albums in their parents' record collections. And at the time, it was kind of the ultimate sign of unhipness.
And, still is.
Yeah. But it was interesting to me to read how, you know, 15 years before I encountered them, that Frank Sinatra and Tony Bennett already had come to hate Miller. Why?
Well, yeah, you know, I'm not sure I'd use that word about Bennett, but Sinatra, yes. And it was a complicated relationship. They were both, Miller and Sinatra, kind of prickly egotists. Sinatra was at Columbia Records in the late 40s, early 50s. It was the low point of his career. His voice wasn't in good shape. His personal life wasn't doing too well with his Ava Gardner relationship. And Miller desperately tried to find a hit for him and put him most famously, paired him with a singer or a personage named Dagmar in this novelty song, Mama Will Bark, with barking dogs. And Sinatra went along with it. He would later claim that he was forced to record it, which wasn't true because he had a refusal clause in his contract. But he could never forgive Miller for urging him to record junk like that. And the two of them, until Sinatra died in 1998, they had this sort of, battle. They never talked to each other, but the battle through the press and interviews and so forth, each one blaming the other for basically everything that was wrong in the world. Tony Bennett, wasn't as volatile a figure as Sinatra. He also chafed a bit at the material Miller gave him, like singing Hank Williams' Cold, Cold Heart and novelty songs and sentimental ballads that sold, and quickly worked out an arrangement that he, for every pop song he recorded, he would be allowed to record a jazz song that would come out on an LP with great jazz musicians and great material from the Great American Songbook. The phrase hadn't been invented yet, but songs of the 30s and 40s. And, Tony Bennett is still doing it to this day. So you have to take your hat off to him.
As much as Miller could be seen as responsible for the kind of tacky quality of a lot of pop music in the 50s, he did have a tremendous influence as a producer that, in effect, we get Phil Spector and Sam Phillips and John Landau and Russell Simmons out of the Mitch Miller's model.
Absolutely. His official title was A&R Man, which stood for Artist and Repertory. And that was a well-established job at record companies. And what it meant was that you would hire the artists, the singers, hire backup musicians, decide what songs they would record and then arrange for the art direction and so forth in the album. There was no such thing as a record producer as we know it today. There would be an engineer who would kind of turn the right dials. Well, Miller involved himself in all that. And, as I mentioned, sound effects on Frankie Lane's Mule Train, he would have wooden blocks knocked together to sound like a whip. And the cry of the wild geese, he'd have French horn that sounded like geese. He'd have harpsichords and overdubbing and all sorts of stuff that others were doing as well, Les Ford and Patti Page. But he really was a very activist producer, and he basically invented that modern job.
Is that entirely a good thing? Your book tracks the question of control in the music industry, not only who shapes the music in the studio, but who holds the rights to that music. And that's not just the ASCAP BMI wars, but questions of payola and disc jockeys and all of that. So the invention of the record producer, the song producer, becomes a kind of center of power in the music industry.
That's true. And, the music industry was never clean as driven snow. I mean, the word payola came to prominence from some congressional hearings in the late 50s, but it was coined by Variety magazine way back, I believe, in the 20s, if not the 30s. There were all sorts of favors and bribes changing hands under the table. So that was just something that was always the case in the music industry, countered by the fact that the public had to buy it. I mean, even if a disc jockey was given money to play a song, if the public didn't want it, it wouldn't buy it. And together with the record producer like a Mitch Miller, predating that, in fact, after the war, the disc jockey became a powerful institution. So every city had their popular disc jockeys who, frankly, were mostly, if not almost all, willing to accept favors. They would parse it in different ways. I'm sure very few would play a song they thought was horrible just for being paid a bribe. But they could be convinced to play it more. And some disc jockeys had the power to make a song a hit. So that also eventually led the music business into some trouble.
And in some cases, those disc jockeys were responsible for the rise of rock and roll because they were willing to play what constituted race records, black music, to a white teen population.
Yeah, in the late 40s, early 50s, some of these, the hipper disc jockeys, Alan Freed being the most famous, broke racial barriers. They played, as you said, what were described as race records, and there was a strict segregation in music business that traditionally those were only played on black stations and stations listened by white listeners would not play an R&B song by a Ruth Brown or a Muddy Waters. These hip young DJs picked them up, and the teenagers followed suit. And, that was the late 40s, early 50s, and that directly led to rock and roll. People like Elvis were listening to those songs from, when they were in knee pants.
The accusation at the time and subsequent histories is that was one of the ways rock and roll got on the air was through payola. They felt Congress and people in authority felt that this stuff couldn't really be popular, that it was only through bribery that you got rock and roll on the air.
Right. And there were all sorts of kind of paranoid conspiracy theories. In 1953, a group of ASCAP songwriters sued BMI and the record companies and the radio networks for $150 million, claiming that they conspired to favor BMI songs over ASCAP songs. There was no basis to that. And similarly, just as you say, when the ASCAP powers that be ignored rock and roll, then they tried to dismiss it. Then when they saw it was a real event happening, they said, it's only because of payola. And even though there was payola, history has shown that rock and roll had much more going for it than that.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. We'll be returning after a short break. We are discussing the rise and fall of the Great American Songbook with Ben Yagoda, author of The Bee's Side. Stay with us.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, with test preparation courses for graduate school admission, including the GRE, GMAT, and LSAT. smu.edu/test-prep.
Kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. Kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat or help you at the automat. Men grow cold, these girls grow old. We all lose our charm in the end. But square cut or pear shape, these rocks don't lose their shape. Diamonds are a girl's best friend.
That is Fort Worth's own T-Bone Burnett covering Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend from the 1949 musical Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jerome Weeks, filling in for Chris Boyd, and we're talking to Ben Yagoda today, the author of The B-Side, The Death of Tin Pan Alley and the Rebirth of the Great American Song. And I chose Burnett's version because so many rock musicians the past 20 years or so have gone back to the Great American Songbook, from Harry Nilsson to Linda Ronstadt and Rod Stewart, Natalie Cole, Lady Gaga, and they've often done it in a lush, worshipful manner. Perhaps they hope a bit of the old stardust rubs off on them. But T-Bone Burnett chose one of the more cynical numbers from the songbook and then does a kind of Velvet Underground treatment of it that only seems to amplify the cynicism.
No, I love it. I was thinking Lou Reed meets Bob Dylan meets T-Bone Burnett.
I once interviewed T-Bone Burnett and asked him why people kept comparing him to Lou Reed, and he said, because I have three notes in my voice. But that brings up the question, because so much of this Great American Songbook has been coming revived in the last 20 years by rock and rollers like the people I named. How much of this newfound exploration is kind of nostalgia in the face of a world governed by hip-hop?
Well, it's a good question, but I would point to, you mentioned the past 20 years, the subtitle of my book, talks about the rebirth of the great American song. And that's really two things. And going back to an earlier part of our conversation, in fact, the very beginning, the 1954 Sinatra album that you mentioned, on which he had The Way You Look Tonight. That was the song, wasn't it? The Way You Look Tonight.
You can't take that away from me.
Can't take that away from me. Sorry. Yeah. Another classic. And, you know, that was the start of that one of those two rebirths, that just as this tradition was ending, people like Sinatra very strongly, but also Fred Astaire came out with an album of standards right about that time, followed by Ella Fitzgerald, Mel Torme, Sarah Vaughan, Bennett, all the way through. And that led on to the rockers that you're talking about, like Willie Nelson in the 80s and Linda Ronstadt with her collaborations with Nelson Riddle. And, you know, I think it long ago was established that this canon of music is great and enduring and standards and all those things. So it's natural that different people would want to take a crack at it. Now, some do a better job. I like that song you just played and the Ronstadt albums and the Willie Nelson is great. Others, you know, not so great. You know, Rod Stewart and some other names that seem a little bit like, as you said, ploys for nostalgia, kind of phoning it in, relying on the quality of the song. So, but, you know, these songs are big boys and girls now. They can stand up to that, and they are not going
anywhere. I think that's another definition of a standard, as a song that can take a certain amount of abuse.
That's a very good point, yeah.
But you also argue that in the 60s, with the Beatles, Nashville, and Motown, a kind of a new respect for song craftsmanship comes back. But it comes back with a difference. I was wondering if we can play a little bit of a Holland Dozier Holland classic. You know, you write in the book that song was written in less than a day. It was written in the afternoon in a response from Motown because Columbia was re-releasing some old four tops, and they didn't, they wanted a response to it. So what do the blues, rhythm and blues, country western, and rock and roll do to the American songbook?
Well, you know, I think that these new standards, if you can put it that way, and I actually have a website called newamericansongbook.org where I kind of take nominations and propose nominations for songs written after 1960 that are worthwhile and worthy to be called standards. They're very different. You know, one way of looking at it was the earlier songs were composed on the piano for the most part, with all the complex harmonies at great pianists like Gershwin or Arlen's disposal. The newer songs on the guitar, which has a simpler palette, certainly some exceptions. You know, that song you play, the same old song, that beat, 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 insistent pounding beat is not something you would find in a, older jazz standard. But, you know, Motown was a great example. Barry Gordy started it, and he talked to some of the New York publishers and took some of their ideas back to Detroit. And it really was a kind of a factory, much like a Tin Pan Alley publishing house from, you know, like 1922. He had staff composers and staff arrangers and the great backup musicians that were the subject of that wonderful movie a few years back. And just, you know, and brilliant writers like Smokey Robinson and Dozier, Holland Dozier. Who would just churn out these great songs. And there were some clunkers, but like a Smokey Robinson song like My Girl or Tracks of My Tears is just a wonderful song.
We have a caller from Arlington, Ed, with a question. Ed?
Hi. I had two questions, one of which is where would the guest, Mr. Yagoda, I believe is the name?
Yes, Ben Yagoda.
Place a song like Arlo Guthrie's The City of New Orleans, which I heard broadcast several times this weekend on KERA. think it would be difficult to argue that it's anything other than a great American song, but I've never really heard it attributed to the Great American Songbook. In fact, I think I said it was Arlo Guthrie's. He's the performer of it, but I think it was written by a guy named Steve Fromholtz.
No, Steve Goodman. Yeah, Steve Goodman.
Steve Goodman, yeah.
Steve Goodman, yeah, okay.
Great song, and a classic, certainly in its way. And I would say, though, a different sort of thing. I mean, definitely, we mentioned the rhythm and blues and country tradition. That came out of the folk tradition. And, you know, if it has three chords, you know, that's all it has. A simple song, but memorable in its way. I don't feel like, even though Arlo Guthrie made a classic out of the Steve Goodman song, it would stand up to many other interpretations.
Well, that's exactly what I wanted to get into. Is,
yeah.
I think in the pop world, once somebody sets the performance standard for a song, an artist really takes a risk by departing from that standard in any way. It would be really rare to go to a pop performance and hear anybody else try to perform the City of New Orleans. And I think that's where maybe a pop or a rock or folk standards depart from the Great American Songbook that you're talking
yeah.
about. Is one performance kind of sets the standard in pop music and nobody touches it thereafter.
Well, yes and no. I mean, a lot of the great rock artists do one or two or three cover songs in their sets and can do great things with them. It tends to be the more, a little bit more complex songs than the one that you mentioned. There's a couple of great websites, Secondhand Songs and Cover Me, that are devoted to the phenomenon of cover songs, and there have been some great ones.
I had a friend who played guitar and took requests in a bar. This was way back in the early 80s, and he said the three most requested songs were The City of New Orleans, mm-hmm. Me and Bobby McGee, and I knew I was going to forget the other one. Oh, my gosh. Anyway, the weird thing about them was – the weird thing about them was they all mentioned New Orleans. Me and Bobby McGee, it opens with they're headed to – they're hitchhiking to
– Busted yeah, flat in Baton Rouge.
Yeah, right. And he said it drove him nuts after a while singing the same three songs but every night. They certainly were standards.
Well, it doesn't surprise me because New Orleans is such an important city. The great Alan Toussaint, who I had the opportunity to interview for my book, that scene in the 50s and into the 60s, great music and great songs coming out of there. And so it doesn't surprise me that just a mention like a talisman in a song would be a good thing for a song.
My editor, Rick Holter, just brought this question up this morning to me, and it's something not addressed directly in your book, The B-Side, but the entire issue of standards and nostalgia comes to the forefront at this time of year. If anything has kept some standards going strong, even through their leanest years, it has to be Christmas.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the peak period of Tin Pan Alley. And of course, you know, I should make sure to say that in those golden years, as with any other period, 80% of what came out was junk. Maybe in the early 50s, 90% was junk, but certainly plenty of junky stuff and plenty of novelty tunes. Mm. And, you know, the holiday song was always something that was in demand. So whether it was greatest selling song of all time, White Christmas by Irving Berlin, or the probably the greatest novelty holiday number, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer by Johnny Marx, or the Christmas song by Mel Torme, all of whom were Jewish, by the way, as the writer of most of the Christmas songs were, was a big subcategory of popular songs through all these years.
But as I said, it does bring up that sense of, I think, Christmas songs often bring a sense of nostalgia, the memory of childhood. And so it's a natural thing to kind of reach back into the past, the songs that you heard. Harper's Index recently cited that the average age of a holiday song played on the American radio is 67 years old. But if you're thinking about it, Away in a Manger was written in 1895, so that kind of skews the numbers.
Right, and one right about that 60-70-year period is one of the great pieces of nostalgia, and more than nostalgia, great emotion and sentiment, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas, by Martin and Blaine from 1944 is perennial, wonderful song.
Well, you've been listening to Think on KERA 90.1. We've been talking to Ben Yagoda, author of The B-Side, The Death of Tin Pan Alley, and The Rebirth of the Great American Song. My name is Jerome Weeks, and I've been filling in for Chris Boyd. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact us via email at think@kera.org. And I want to thank you, Mr. Yagoda. I've often read your work in publications, and I respect it a great deal. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much. Really, really fun conversation. Thank you.
I'll just be the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams. No, no, they can't take that away from me. We may never, never meet again on that bumpy road to love. Still, I'll always, always keep the memory of the way you hold your knife, do-do-do-do-do-do, the way we danced until three, the way you've changed my life. No, no, they can't take that away from me. No, they can't take that.